This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 124 was recorded on June 28th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. One River CIO Eric Peters is back as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss a host of topics ranging from U.S. dollar reserve currency status to unwinding of quantitative easing to labor participation rates and the Phillips curve to unfunded liabilities and the return of inflation. Patrick Serezna is off this week, so Kevin Muir, market strategist at East West Investment Management and author of the Macro Tourist blog, is taking his place as our co-host this week. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Kevin and I will discuss everything from extended crude oil coverage to a paper Kevin just wrote comparing U.S. and Canadian banks, and I'll also be asking Kevin what he'll be presenting at our Macro Voices live event in Toronto on August 10th. Finally, we also have a special announcement for our Russian listeners after today's market wrap.
And I'm Kevin Muir. It's great to be with you today, Eric. I see the S&P closed up today, 2716, but it had a tough week, closing almost on the lows of the week. What's your thinking in here?
Well, as I said last week, it seems pretty darn clear that a short-term top is in. The big question in my mind is there going to be another wave up to this summer rally, or is it over already? I'm leaning a little bit towards maybe a wave higher, but I have to be honest, I've been really busy with oil markets this week. I haven't been paying that much attention to equities. Either way, from my perspective, what's really important is not so much whether or not we've got another wave that maybe gets us back above 2,800. What I'm more concerned with is what happens in the second half of the year, particularly in the fourth quarter. I think that maybe the ingredients here are finally in place for the combination of QE unwinding and the business cycle ending and everything else for things to get really ugly. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. We've heard some pretty smart people opine in the opposite direction, but I'm more interested in what the longer picture looks like. I don't know when the summer rally ends, but maybe the top's already in. We'll see what happens.
Let's move on to the U.S. dollar. It was pushing up against 95.30 earlier in the week, but it's actually sagged down to almost 94. But the past couple of days, it's pushed back up, and we're back at the top of the range at 95.30. What's your thinking? Is it going to head higher, or are we kind of in the process of making a top in here?
Well, you know, we seem to be seeing some pretty stiff resistance at 95, but it keeps pushing through it. You could make that argument for a false breakout, but, you know, usually false breakouts, if they're false, they stay false. You don't see another retest like we've seen here. So it looks to me like, you know, my leaning is still towards higher. The bears will eventually be proven right. Long-term fundamentals are definitely in place for a bearish outlook for the dollar, but I think it potentially has quite a bit more upside and quite a bit more time before we get to that point.
Let's move on to crude oil. How did last week's inventories numbers look, Eric?
Well, remember what I said last week on the show, which is we had some heavy weather outside the Houston Ship Channel that screwed everything up. And my comment last week was fade the significance of whatever numbers we see. They might be crazy and they're not necessarily representative of what's really going on. Sure enough, what we got, 9.9 million barrel drawdown in crude oil inventories. It sounds like, oh my gosh, that's horrendous. Who could imagine what could possibly have happened to cause such a huge drawdown? Well, how about the Houston Ship Channel being closed to imports coming in, but open to a huge number of exports going out? That'll do it every time. So again, the weather has biased the numbers, and I don't read a lot of significance into it. There was an estimate, though, of 2.6 million barrels on the drawdown, and we saw 9.9. So in terms of just dramatically missing market expectations, that was why we saw such a big reaction to the inventory number. What I find a little more concerning, actually, is the 2.7 million barrel drawdown in Cushing, Oklahoma. Now, Cushing, Oklahoma is not affected by weather outside the Houston Ship Channel. We've seen a trend lately of significant drawdowns. They're below 40% of capacity now. And as we'll get into later on, time spreads are telling us a just very, very interesting story about a real crisis situation of insufficient oil being available short term in the physical market in Cushing, Oklahoma. We'll come back to that a little bit later on. Gasoline, meanwhile, building 1.2 million barrels this week. Distillates building a de minimis 15,000 barrels. Not really a significant number. Let's just call it flat on distillates this week. Now, production was unchanged, but I have to thank one of our listeners who notified me of a change I was not aware of in EIA reporting. Effective in June, they've changed the rules, and this is the government at work here. I don't see any benefit to this change, frankly, but what they used to do is tell us each week what the change was in U.S. production. They've changed their policy to round it to the nearest 100,000 barrels as a matter of policy. So what that means is you either get an unchanged on the week or you get 100,000 barrels in a single week. And the only way you can make any meaningful interpretation of the increase or decrease in production each week is to take those big 100,000 at a time changes and, you know, divide how many weeks it's been since it was unchanged and try to make sense of it. They used to tell us on a weekly basis, and maybe the data was so inaccurate that they decided that rounding it made more sense. I'm not sure what the motivation was for the change. But the reason it's unchanged is not that suddenly we stopped growing production, but rather the EIA suddenly stopped reporting anything other than round numbers of 100,000 at a time. Exports up to, I'm not sure if this is a record or not, but it's 3 million barrels a day, 21 million barrels on the week. So even with that massive 10 million barrel drawdown in crude oil inventories, it would have been 10 million barrels in the other direction if it was still illegal to export oil. So really, really big exports. I think that a lot of what's been driving that is the Brent WTI spread. We'll talk more about that later on because that's been affected very much by the action in time spreads this week. So, you know, despite the weather, this was a pretty darn big draw on inventory. It's got everybody freaked out. But I do think that the actual number was biased by the data. So you've got to fade it to a certain extent.
Eric, for the past couple of weeks, you've been keeping us abreast of the freak blowout in time spreads near the front end of the WTI term structure. Is there anything new to report there?
There's quite a lot to report, so much that we're not going to be able to fit it in the market wrap. So let's defer most of this extended crude oil conversation to the postgame segment, because I know everybody is really looking forward to hearing Eric Peters in the feature interview. Very briefly, the summary is the market is way up this week. It's not exactly what most people think. There are a lot of signals, the way they've been reported in the trade press and the descriptions of what's been driving the market, I don't think are accurate. And okay, if I don't think they're accurate, why not? It's a long and involved answer. So let's save the rest of the crude oil conversation for postgame, Kevin. The executive summary for now is it wasn't just the Iran news which really got things going this week. There's more to it than meets the eye.
Let's move on to gold. It's been a tough week for the precious little fella. I see it down from 1300 and closing at 1250. What are your thoughts there?
Well, Kevin, I'm looking at 1249 spot 50, so it looks like just in the last hour or so, we finally took out that round number at 1250 just by half a dollar. And, you know, I think the real question to ask yourself is how much farther does the U.S. dollar have to go to the upside? I really think that's the primary driver here. Now, if you think, as Jeffrey Sherman from Double Line described on the program recently, that the dollar is almost done here, that it's about to reverse and the dollar is going to fall off a cliff and head south, then boy, this sure looks to me like a pretty darn good time to buy gold. Thing is, I don't think that. I think the dollar's still got some more upside to it. And if I'm right about that, probably gold has a little more downside before this is done. So I'm waiting it out. I do think that gold has a really, really big move to the upside in the next couple of years. I don't think the bottom's quite in yet. And I guess what I want to say is, you know, I look at this stuff every day. If you're a retail investor and you don't have a whole lot of time to follow the market closely, this is not a bad place to be buying gold if your intention is to buy and hold it for the next several years. I think if you are a careful observer of markets and you really want to wait until a clear sign is in that the bottom has occurred and the trend has reversed, I don't think that we're there yet, but it feels to me like we're getting close.
On to treasuries. I see that the 10-year is still stuck in this range, roughly between 280 and 3%. Towards the end of this week, it's pushed down to 284, and it's sitting at the bottom of the range again. Do you think it's going to break down? Do you think bonds are headed higher from here?
You know, the way I look at this, Kevin, is I think we're in that consolidation range, which is kind of the final countdown, if you will, to a resolution of, are we going to see the really big break that everybody has talked about and anticipated? It is no surprise to me that we kind of had a false break. There were so many people getting ahead of themselves. There was so much short interest in 10-year treasuries that, you know, we got just very briefly past that 305 critical level. It didn't last, and now we're back into this trading range. I think what happens is we stay here for a while, and then we break pretty darn hard in one direction or the other. The more likely one, I guess, is toward higher yields. But, you know, as Patrick has talked about with some of the big options trades that have been placed, it could go the other way still. I don't think the jury is completely out. But one thing is clear, which is so many people thought, okay, as soon as it goes past 305, that's it. It's going to just crash from there. It's not happening. I think that we've got maybe the rest of the summer for this consolidation period to continue. Once we do get a decisive move, and you said 2 spot 80 to 3 spot 0, I'm going to broaden that and say when we get a decisive move, a weekly close that's, say, either below 2 spot 60 or above 3 spot 10, and it stays that way, I think that's where the real big move is likely to start from there. And I think we're in a consolidation. I think it's more likely to break upside in yield, downside in prices, but I could see either way.
Eric, thanks for that update. Before we move on to the future interview, we have a couple housekeeping announcements. First, you mentioned in the opening that you have a special announcement for our Russian listeners. What's on your mind?
Well, we've spoken on the program quite a bit in the past about Sergei Glazyev, the Russian scholar who is credited by many people as being the mastermind of the de-dollarization strategy, where Russia, China, and other BRICS countries are looking for ways to eliminate their dependence on the U.S. dollar as international trade currency. That's the first topic that I'm going to discuss with Eric Peters, actually, and in this week's Research Roundup, we have a link to a video that I think all of our listeners are going to find very interesting. Now, something we discussed about a year ago was the idea of getting Sergei Glazyev on the program himself as a feature interview guest to give him the opportunity to tell his side of the story as to why he believes that the U.S. is actually engaging, in his words, in financial terrorism by using access to the SWIFT payment system as a way to manipulate and control the activities of other countries and to enforce sanctions upon them. Now, we ruled that out after a number of people informed us that, unfortunately, Sergei Glazyev does not speak English at all. As evidenced by the video from June 8th, if Sergei Glazyev didn't speak English last year, he's an awfully good student, because he's most certainly fluent in the video that we've got linked in your Research Roundup, which is from June 8th. So having discovered that Sergei Glazyev does, in fact, speak fluent English, we'd love to get him on the program. I want to be clear, it's not a setup, as he might be fearful of, from Western media. I want to give Sergei the opportunity to tell his side of the story. Why does he see the actions of the West as the threat? And why does he see it as necessary for BRICS countries to protect themselves from the actions of the West by eliminating the dollar in their trade? We've tried to contact Sergei Glazyev through the university system. He's a professor there. We've also tried to contact him through his own personal website. And all of the emails that we've tried to send have bounced. We haven't gotten a no back. We've just gotten bounced emails. So we are unsuccessful in contacting Sergei Glazyev. So if we have any Russian listeners who are able to contact Sergei Glazyev, please do so and let him know that we would like to invite him to be a feature interview guest here on Macro Voices and to have an opportunity to tell his side of the de-dollarization story that we have discussed with Luke Roman and other guests here on the program.
Okay, next up, how about an update on the Macro Voices live event in Toronto on August 10th? I hear another featured speaker has been added to the roster since last week.
Kevin, we are really excited. We were able to get Josh Steiner signed up from HedgeEye. Josh is the financials guy at HedgeEye, but he's probably best known as a Canadian real estate guy. He's got quite a bit to say on Canadian real estate valuations and the threat that he believes the overvaluation of the Canadian real estate market poses to the Canadian banking system. Needless to say, many of the attendees of the Toronto event will be Canadians, so what a perfect match to have a topic so close to home for our Canadian attendees. Meanwhile, Kevin, I really want to emphasize, I know, folks, it just sounded like a sales pitch when I said buy your tickets early to sell out. Well, guess what? They're selling out. We've sold 2/3 of the tickets total, and we're not even halfway through our early bird registration period, which ends July 15th. So do not get upset with us. We warned you. If you want to go to this event, you should buy your tickets because I do think it's going to sell out. We're 2/3 of the way there already, and it's going to be a fairly small event. We do not have any ability to increase or add seats or change to a different room. We've already paid for this venue, which only holds 150 people. So if you don't have your ticket yet, be sure to get it. And we're really excited about the way this is coming together. I'm going to want to ask you what you're going to be speaking about, Kevin, but let's save that for the post-game segment after the feature interview.
I know I'm looking forward to the conference. It's going to be a lot of fun. And now on to this week's featured interviewed guest, Eric Peters, CIO at One River Asset Management. Eric's interview with Mr. Peters is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Returning now for his second feature interview is One River Asset Management's Eric Peters. Eric, I'm so excited to get you back on the program. There's quite a number of topics that I'm looking forward to talking to you about, but one of them we've been discussing quite a bit lately is the reserve currency status of the U.S. dollar, and particularly the fact that a lot of people around the world have an incentive to change that status. Even though I think a lot of American investors don't take this risk seriously, the U.S. derives a lot of benefits from having that reserve currency status. Recently, Sergei Glazyev, the Russian scholar who has been credited as the mastermind of the de-dollarization campaign that is trying to persuade the BRICS countries to abandon the dollar, had a video in English. We've got the link to that in the Research Roundup email for listeners' benefit. And Mr. Glazyev is very outspoken. He is accusing the United States of financial terrorism by using and withholding access to the SWIFT international payment system, which is the international wire transfer system, as a way to enforce sanctions. Eric, I know you've done a lot of thinking and a lot of research about this. You know, most people I talk to, either they never heard of this stuff or they're not concerned about it. How do you feel? Am I crazy to think that we should be concerned about the people in the world who would like to replace the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency?
For starters, thanks for having me back, Eric. I really appreciate it. Enjoyed the first interview and looking forward to this one. Should we be concerned? This is a topic that people have been talking about for quite a few decades, which is the status of the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency. And there certainly have been episodes throughout my career where there have been concerns that we have abused the privilege of the reserve currency. Typically, the thought process is that by running loose monetary policy, in a sense, we are working to undermine the value of the dollar. And so those people throughout the world who hold the dollars will at some point grow tired of having their store of value degraded, you know, by our monetary policy, and will eventually shift their reserves elsewhere. The problem is there aren't a lot of good solutions. Gold is a very small market. The euro, certainly for a period of time or at various points in time, has seemed to be a potential alternative, although I think it's difficult to have a lot of confidence in the euro presently. And so there isn't really a great alternative. People aren't really putting their money into the renminbi. People don't really want to keep their money in yen. There are not a lot of great alternatives. What's happening now is something rather different, which is that people are beginning to grow concerned about the dollar's place as the principal reserve currency because of our policies whereby we're using the dollar as a fairly blunt tool to threaten some of our trading partners and certainly adversaries. So we, in a sense, have used this payment system, this global payment system that you referred to called SWIFT, and we're beginning to use it in a relatively unorthodox way. And what it's allowing us to do, it's allowing us to threaten any corporation that may be engaged in trade with a company or a country that that we're unhappy with. It's allowing us to, in essence, freeze them out of this global payment system, which really reduces or eliminates their ability to transact in global commerce in a very material way. And so, in a sense, we can hold companies or countries hostage using this. And the consequence of that is that it's certainly accelerating the work that some of our adversaries, principally Russia and, you know, to a degree China, it's accelerating their moves to try to replace the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency. And it's certainly in their interest to replace it. They want to get off the dollar, you know, the dollar reserve currency standard as quickly as they possibly can. It's just a very difficult thing to do. But that process is underway, and I think the policies that we're pursuing right now, while they give us an awful lot of financial leverage currently, without question are accelerating this move away from the dollar. I don't expect it to happen anytime soon. This is something that's going to take, you know, could happen over the next decade, but it's certainly underway.
Well, that certainly echoes a lot of my feelings. You know, if you are the strongest kid on the block, you can beat up the other kids. But if you abuse that right, the other kids start going to the gym, and it doesn't take too long before they come up with a way to fight back. I want to move on to a slightly broader subject of politics, particularly whether it be United States or Europe. We're seeing, I think, a trend where there's a lot of a shift towards nationalism. We used to be really, the world was focused on globalism and free trade. Now we've suddenly got President Trump really focusing a lot on what I would consider to be protectionist policies. A lot of other companies around the world are doing the same thing. Of course, Britain, the Brexit referendum, the Italian revolt that's going on, so many things around the world. Where do you see this all going, and what are the implications longer term for financial markets?
That's a great question. It's a big question. Historically, and I think this is what people are concerned about, protectionism has not been a policy that's led to great growth or, you know, terrific outcomes. I think we're all familiar with it. We're familiar with the experience of the 1930s. Consequently, you know, when you talk about anything that has to do with trade or protectionism, the inclination is to be pretty alarmist. And I think that there is some reason for alarm. At the same time, there's no question that our trading relationships were set up for a different time in history. And it stands to reason that there's some things that probably should be updated. So it's hard to update things without creating a stir. And so, you know, we're in that process. Whether it tips into really destructive protectionism, time will tell. I think that it will impact the markets in quite substantial ways, irrespective of whether it's just a trade renegotiation or if it is protectionism. I just think the outcomes are more extreme if it turns into a real U.S. isolation, U.S. protectionist type outcome. And it's difficult to really handicap that because there's so many different players at the table, and it's hard to know what types of decisions they're ultimately going to make. And I think that's what makes the current environment so interesting. And this is going to run slightly astray of your question, but for the last few decades, we've been in this world where central banks have dominated policy, and every major central bank in the world has adopted the U.S. monetary policy. And that policy has been a very predictable policy. Anytime there's a wobble in financial markets, anytime there's a recession, they cut rates. As economies recover, they hike rates, and the swings have been more extreme through time because they've had to do more and more as more and more debt has been added to the global economy. And different countries have moved at different paces. But that said, everyone's been on the same system. And now what's happening is that I think central bank activity has led us to this destination, which, and I'm sure we'll talk about it later, for a whole host of reasons, I think, has created this populist revolt. And the thing about that is that in a sense, if you think that the central banks have led us to this place, it's highly unlikely that they're going to be able to deliver the solution to get us out of this place. And so I think what voters have done is they've said, without pointing their finger specifically at banks, they've said, I don't like where we are. I want something different. So I'm going to vote this politician in, and I expect them to do something really material to get us out of, you know, whatever place that we're in right here. And that's so interesting because unlike a world where we have homogeneous central banking, we now have a world where we have all these different politicians, whether it's in the US, whether it's in the UK with Brexit, whether it's in France with Macron, whether it's in Italy now with Five Star and the League, and Germany appears to be undergoing a political shift, and certainly Poland and Hungary. So we're seeing it all over the world. You now have this new group of politicians that in a sense really have a mandate, and they're different. So the policy decisions that Italy makes are going to be very different from the policy decisions that the U.S. makes and probably Germany makes and potentially the U.K. makes. So we're moving from this world where everyone has kind of been on the same system, which is a central banking dominated system, to a system where there are a lot of politics involved. And so that's why it's difficult to handicap. It's also why there should be a lot of real differentiation in markets. And I think more volatility in markets. Because of that, markets will really need to reprice over the next couple of years, and not in an upward way, and in kind of a downward way. But there also is going to be a lot of differentiation.
I want to stay on that topic of central banks and the era of central banking. I recently interviewed Nomi Prinz on this program. In her book, Collusion, she writes about how, you know, everybody's freaking out about $4.5 trillion on the Fed's balance sheet. That's like a quarter of the global number. It's upwards of $20 trillion that has been conjured by central banks around the world. And, you know, at some point, if there were a certain set of beneficial effects of creating all this money over the last 10 years, it stands to reason that the unwind might not be so pretty. So it seems like we're maybe at the beginning of the end. You know, the Fed is definitely extinguishing U.S. dollar supply. The ECB was still creating more, as was the Bank of Japan, although it looks like maybe they're finally ready to curtail. When do we get to the point where there is a net reduction of central bank balance sheets around the world, and what are the consequences, and what is it going to mean for markets when that happens?
Well, you can pull out your calendar and you can look at what the central banks are telling us they're going to do, and you can run your calculations, and it looks like that real tipping point is the latter part of this year into early next year when we go into contraction of global central bank balance sheets. That said, they can, you know, they all reserve the right to change their minds. So it could conceivably be faster, although I think that's highly unlikely, but it could certainly be, you know, could certainly be a lot slower. I think that in terms of how that's going to impact markets, I take your point that central bank balance sheets have really expanded quite dramatically, and presumably that's had a positive impact on economies. And I think that is conventional wisdom is that's the case. And as a consequence, when you remove that, it's going to be negative. And in a lot of ways, that makes sense. I'm a real skeptic that we all understand the complexity of money and credit in the global system and how QE interacts with it. And so what I mean by that is I think that people felt that they understood what QE would do to the economy and to inflation when they first introduced it, you know, really kind of 08, 09. And yet, by and large, or really virtually universally, people were really wrong in the sense that they expected inflation to increase in a really material way and economic activity to increase quite dramatically. And they really didn't end up with that. They ended up with really quite static inflation and arguably disinflation and really, you know, muted growth. So now what people are assuming is that, you know, as they exit QE, that you're going to have lower inflation and lower growth. And that may be the case, but I think it's worth considering that QE, other than the early round of QE, which staved off a depression, but the consequent rounds of QE that really helped inflate financial asset prices, I think you could make the case that it was actually disinflationary. and reduced economic growth. And the channel by which that would have happened would have been, the obvious one is through the financialization of the U.S. economy, where a lot of QE went into suppressing rates, went into resulting in corporate issuance that resulted in stock buybacks, and companies just decided to not really make big capital investments. So it may very well be the case that as central banks exit from these policies, that actually you see something happen in reverse, where you see this financialization effect unwound somewhat, and you see the velocity of money actually increase as interest rates go higher. You see economic activity pick up as interest rates go higher, and you see inflation pick up as interest rates go higher. That'd be a really interesting dynamic. It would have the benefit of symmetry in the sense that QE seemed to lead to very muted inflation, and so the unwind and surprised people, and so the unwind could be rather unexpected. I think that that's an environment that could be pretty good for actual economic activity, although I think it would be pretty challenging for financial asset prices.
Let's move on to labor in the United States, because something that's gotten a lot of headlines recently is, hey, we're moving down to unemployment levels that haven't been seen since the 1960s. Hooray for the U.S. economy. Everything's firing on eight cylinders. And I kind of think, wait a minute, what happened to all those stories that I read saying that a lot of these statistics were skewed because so many people had dropped out of the workforce and were not looking for employment anymore, that the number wasn't really correct? So are we really seeing the extreme, profound, low level of unemployment that the statistics are indicating? Is it really true, or is that a statistical anomaly? And what does it mean in terms of inflation and the economy in general if it's true?
We've all looked at the stats, and you know, we're now at an unemployment rate in the U.S. of sub 4, 3.8, 3.7. I think what a lot of people focus on is if the participation rate were back where it was pre-2008, that you'd end up with an unemployment rate that had an 8 handle or something like that. So that's what people are referring to. But, you know, making comparisons like that is difficult because a lot of things are changing. You know, the U.S. Labor force is shrinking because people are getting older. There's this opioid issue and this disability issue, which are difficult to really handicap in terms of how big an impact that's having on the U.S. labor force. But when I look at it and when I think about this large pool of labor that is supposedly idle, and if I imagine that there are just a whole group of people that are eager to get back in the workforce but just haven't bothered trying at this point, or they're stuck on disability and they don't want to get off, or they're stuck on disability and they can't get off, or they're addicted to opioids, or you know what, or they're just old. When I think about that, it just doesn't sound like a really robust supply of efficient labor that's ready to come back into the market. And I think now that we're at these levels of unemployment, if we were going to see real jumps in the participation rate, I think we'd see more signs of that. If anything, it's pretty sticky. In terms of it leading to inflation, we think that's just inevitable. And there's been a lot of talk about the Phillips curve just being flat in perpetuity. If you go back to the original work on the Phillips curve, it really shows that wages start increasing once you get below 4%. And that is really where that relationship accelerates, such that lower levels of unemployment lead to significantly higher wages. And that would be our expectation of what we're likely to see. When you look at certain segments of the economy, you're absolutely seeing that. You're just not seeing it on a completely widespread basis. That said, wages are increasing. You know, they're increasing, and they're increasing at a faster rate. And that's what we would expect to see with levels of unemployment down where we are right now.
I want to touch on liabilities as well, because this is a topic that a lot of people have stopped talking about. I'm not sure why, but U.S. government's debt to GDP is over 100%. I think the number is 108% now. If you add in unfunded entitlements and liabilities, it kind of depends on who you listen to, because there are different ways of calculating that. I think Larry Kotlikoff has the record at a fiscal gap at $202 trillion. Other people have calculated differently and come up with about about a $50 trillion additional debt beyond the debt that we admit is the debt. One way or another, even if you only consider the official $21 trillion of U.S. debt, you're still well past the 100% threshold that Reinhardt and Rogoff in their research identified as where, you know, you kind of get to a point of no return where countries are in real trouble if they get past that point. So we're either just a little past that or way past it, depending on whether you consider the entitlement liabilities. Where is all this headed? It seems like, you know, 5-6 years ago, a lot of people were talking about this. I haven't heard so much about it lately. When does this come back and bite us?
108% of GDP number, or some number around that, is, I think, is accurate. Although that doesn't take into consideration the fact that the Fed owns about $4 trillion of debt. So the numbers as a percentage is not quite so big. It's probably closer to around 80% in terms of U.S. government debt held by the public. But those are rounding errors once you start including entitlements and those unfunded liabilities. That's just a challenging question to answer, because no one knows exactly when these issues become, you know, really big issues. But what we certainly can observe is that people are getting older and more people are beginning to draw on these entitlements. And we can also be certain that the math doesn't work. So it's a problem that will be extremely difficult to solve. I don't have any idea what the solution is, because the difference between what people expect they will be entitled to and what the economy can deliver, that gap is just so vast that it really is, it's unsolvable. So in a way, the question becomes, well, how might we solve it? And I think one of the things we don't do is, one of the things the government will not do is will not try to solve it through disinflation. I think it will ultimately attempt to try to address it. It's not going to be solved, but it'll try to address it through inflation. The question is, how do they do that? And why inflation versus deflation? I think for the simple reason that, this is the way my simple brain works. In an inflationary environment, it's just easier to screw people, because the numbers are moving around a lot more than in deflation. So as we all know, it's a lot easier to give someone a raise than a pay cut. In an inflationary period, it's, you know, it's a lot easier to increase someone's entitlement, cost of living adjustment by a little bit, and they feel like, well, they're getting a little bit more money, even if on an inflation adjusted basis, it's not even close. And so I just don't see how this won't be addressed through some form of inflation. Over what time horizon, that's awfully difficult to, that's difficult to know.
You've described in a number of ways that we're kind of in an era of central banking. Some people have suggested maybe we're at a turning point where the leadership of central banks is changing its mood. You know, in the United States, you had Greenspan, Bernanke, Yellen, all very, very much accommodative, especially in the case of Bernanke and Yellen, not really speaking English. Suddenly, Jay Powell is a very down-to-earth guy, speaks English, and has a different attitude. You look at Mario Draghi ending his term this year, potentially being replaced by a German with a very different attitude toward the role of what central bankers should be doing. Are we potentially at the cusp of a change in global central bank attitude? And if so, what are its implications for the economy and for financial markets?
Well, we don't know about Powell yet. He's more clear spoken than others, for sure. I would find it highly unlikely that he is going to try to be a really hawkish central banker. And the reason for that is, I guess, what I've just described in terms of the government's ultimate desire to create more inflation so that they can address some of these entitlement issues. But more than anything, I think the most important thing to focus on is that the era of central bankers, I really believe, has drawn to a close. And that is because if you look back post Volcker, right, so Greenspan came in 1987, and the reaction function of central bankers has been really the same ever since. And we all know where that led. It ultimately climaxed with QE and this global monetary experiment. But that destination has been one where there has been growing inequality that certainly in the U.S. has reached levels really only seen back in kind of the pre-crash year in the late 1920s. And so it would appear that, at least in our type of society, that when you hit certain natural limits of inequality, that something happens. And in this case, it would, you know, it appears that what's happened is people voted for an anti-establishment president who is elected to try to, listen to the forgotten man, so to say, and ultimately, I think, try to address this issue of income and wealth inequality. And so if the central banks have been, and by the way, that phenomena obviously is not just a U.S. phenomena. So let's imagine the U.S. has led central banking activity and that central banking activity has really led governments for the course of my entire career, you know, since the late 80s. And so if we're now in this transition phase because voters have said, well, the central banks have really been the dominant policymakers, and by and large, governments haven't mattered a whole lot. You know, politicians have had opportunities to address some of these entitlement issues, some of the issues that really matter to people. They haven't done a whole lot, which is why we're here. And so if the central banks have been the ones who have gotten us here, they just, by definition, they're not the ones that are going to get us out of here. So I think, look, we're always going to look at what central banks are doing. They will be important, but I think that they're no longer going to be dominant. What's going to be dominant are the politicians. You're seeing that in the U.S. right now. I know that everyone loves to hang on every word that Powell speaks, and they look at the Fed statement, and people are still trained to look at the Fed dot plots, which are probably going to go away. But, you know, people are trained to look at all these things because that's what they've done their whole careers, but they just are not going to matter that much anymore. You know, whether the Fed's terminal rate is 2.25 or 2.5 or 2.75, these are, it's just, we're not talking about much. What are we going to do in terms of immigration policy? What are we going to do in terms of trade policy? How is that going to impact all these major corporations, global supply chains? These are the things that are really going to matter. What are we going to do about entitlements in the next recession? Are we going to borrow an enormous amount of money? Are we going to do helicopter money? Because I can assure you, the next recession is not going to be solved by the Fed cutting rates from 2.5% to zero, and everything's okay. Their toolkit has been depleted.
Eric, I want to bring in the subject of demographics, which I find absolutely fascinating. You know, so many people are talking about the baby boomers are reaching retirement age, and that changes everything. Raul Paul has been very vocal in his view that it really means a fundamental deflationary change because suddenly all the people that were acquiring financial assets in their retirement are going to be distributing and cashing in. They need to move to bonds because they're too old to be holding stocks. And Raul thinks that it creates a secular bear market scenario. What do you think about, and other people have said inflation can't really happen in an aging society environment. Meanwhile, there's still, you know, the millennial generation and the generation behind it are getting bigger. At some point, they'll have a big impact. How do you see these things coming together? What does it mean in terms of inflation, in terms of equity markets and everything else?
A lot of big questions there. And maybe we can go back, or we can return to the question of whether the sale of assets leads to a secular bear market. Maybe we can go back to that in a minute. Demographics are really fascinating because there's something that you don't have to model. You can really just map out, and they're such a powerful force in markets and economics. But they're not that variable in the sense that you just can't all of a sudden make people. You can make money really quickly. You can issue bonds quickly. You can do lots of things in financial markets, but you can't make people really quickly. I guess you can take them away pretty quickly in war. But the case is made, and I would say this is just complete consensus. It doesn't mean it's wrong, by the way. But the case is made that in a world where people are aging and birth rates are slowing, that you simply can't have inflation. So whenever I hear virtually everyone assume that something is a given in economics, my guard is up just because I think nothing is a given when it comes to economics and markets. Markets and economics are self-reflective. And so as soon as you think you understand how something works, the systems themselves change. And so this demographic thing has just been really interesting to me. And when I try to think through problems or issues or topics like this, what I've done my whole career is just try to create really simple models and, you know, extreme models. And oftentimes you discover something, you know, a bit different than what you would have thought when you create a really simple model in the extreme. So imagine just one society, and it has, you know, reasonable balance between old people and young people. The old people naturally have the wealth, right? And the young people haven't worked very long. And the old people probably set up the system to their benefit just because they got to write the rules and they care more about themselves and their children. At least, you know, I'm creating a model for what the U.S. looks like right now. And so imagine that the society really starts aging rapidly. So what happens? Well, initially it works fine. The old people just start giving bits and pieces of the financial assets that they own, which are stocks and bonds, and but mostly houses. They start exchanging those for goods and services that the young people produce because the old people are, you know, no longer working. And that works fine for a while. But as you really start to age, what happens is the labor force shrinks dramatically in this really simple society. The retired pool expands rapidly. And so all of a sudden you have a lot of demand because while the older people may be consuming less than when they were actively working, they're still consuming and you have very few workers left. And ultimately in that society, you end up with huge inflation in the price of labor, whether it's for producing goods at a factory or services. And so you ultimately end up with all the old people exchanging all of their financial assets and their homes for even the most basic services. I kind of joke, it's just, you know, someone, the last person will exchange their house for, you know, one last diaper change. And that's, if you take it to the extreme, that's kind of what that society looks like. But of course, the world isn't just one country. So then I think, okay, so now let's just make it really simple. So now it's two countries in the world. And one is that rich country that I just described. And the second is, let's say, a less affluent or kind of a poor country. And imagine that you have free trade and immigration, right? And so in that world, the rich aging society, prices still go up because what happens is the labor pool contracts. It definitely draws in a lot of immigrants and a ton of immigrants, right? Because they're the ones that are going to have to come in and do the services and work the factories. And ultimately, that country just ends up consuming an awful lot. And its currency declines in value. Overall labor prices go up. Inflation goes up. But it works. Okay. But if you imagine a world with two countries where you have no immigration and you have free trade, then you end up with a society where you have a rich country where you have very large inflation because you still have a very small labor pool because you don't want immigration. So you don't have people to work your factories. So you have to buy a lot of goods and services from abroad, which means you are selling your financial assets and you have to buy someone else's currency. So the value of your currency goes down a lot. Your trade deficit explodes. The domestic price of services goes up a lot because you have very few people to take care of the old people. So you kind of also end up in this inflationary scenario. So bottom line is when I look at the different potential outcomes, when you think about it in the extreme, it seems to me that an aging society actually creates quite a bit of inflation, certainly in the extreme. So what's interesting is that that's completely at odds with market consensus right now, which is that, well, if an aging society, well, obviously inflation can't go higher. What we're going to discover is actually the opposite.
You know, this is a really, really important point, because if there's anything I've learned in this macro game, it is what's the macro risk you really need to worry about. It's the one where when you describe it, at least half of the people in the industry laugh in your face and tell you you're crazy to even worry about it. And I don't know about you, but from my experience meeting people in finance, I talk about the reasons why I think an eventual return to secular inflation is where the end game starts and where things really come unglued. They literally laugh in my face and they think I'm nuts. Your colleague, Lindsay Politi, did an amazingly, just excellent job putting an 18-page report together, which we have linked in our research roundup email for the benefit of our listeners. Folks, I strongly, strongly encourage you to read Lindsay's piece because it's really excellent. But let's suppose, Eric, that Lindsay's right and that we really are seeing a return to inflation. First of all, as you said, most people don't think that possible, and therefore they're not positioned for it, they're not hedged for it, they're not ready for it. Meanwhile, if I go back to the Raul Paul argument, which says, hey, we've been building up because of demographics the stock market for all these years. It's time to see a secular bear market as investors sell off because due to their age, the people that are holding the assets need to move to fixed income. It doesn't make sense for them to stay invested in at risk in equities. That's just so totally at odds with an inflation forecast, in which case you would expect equity markets to at least have a tailwind from inflation, perhaps not in real terms, but in nominal terms, we should expect higher stock prices. Is it possible to know who's right, and how does this conundrum of differing views get resolved?
There are a few forces at work. One has to do with symmetry, and which I think about a lot when it comes to financial markets. And so we've now had decades of really, really muted inflation and major decline in interest rates, in a real decline in real interest rates. And it's been amplified by central bank activity. And so all of those things have been intended to pull future financial asset returns to the present. That has been what they have attempted to do. And the hope has been that by doing that, that you would create wealth in the here and now that would lead to greater investment, greater economic activity. And, you know, we deal with the fact that financial asset returns have been pulled to the present. We deal with that problem later. And so that's kind of where we are right now. So then the question is, well, if you now create inflation or if inflation appears, and we don't know enough about inflation to know whether it's simply something that we create or it's something that we create and it also appears, and it's a bit of a social phenomena, which I think there's an element of that as well. But if we manage to create inflation, it stands to reason that what drove that pulling forward of financial asset price returns, what drove the pulling of that from the future to the present, then goes and pushes those back out to the future. So I think for symmetry reasons, it makes a lot of sense to me that in an inflationary environment, what you could do is you could, and it would be my core expectation, that you would have to re-rate financial asset prices quite a bit lower. And ultimately that puts them back in a position where they're priced such that you could earn a reasonable return if you held them for a long period of time. But we've kind of gotten the returns, right? So I think that's one thing to take into consideration. When you look back at a period like the 1970s, I don't see us repeating something quite like the 70s. There were very different demographics in the 70s and different, I think, situation in terms of commodities and different in terms of entitlements too, right? So we didn't have the entitlement problems in the 70s, but we had a lot of population growth and we had some issues with Middle Eastern oil, you know, amongst others. But now we just have a different set of problems. I think it'll look different from the 1970s, but that was a period of time where stocks really just kind of went sideways in nominal terms, but they fell a lot in real terms with inflation. So it's interesting when you speak with people, they think that inflation will actually help equities in a way because it will lift earnings and lift prices and everything. I think history suggests the opposite. And given that we are priced where we are right now, because of low rates and muted inflation, you know, our calculations are that if inflation increases even moderately, so let's call it from this 2-ish level to 4 to 5%. By the way, you know, we were at 5.5% inflation in 2008. So we're not talking about crazy forecasts. But if we really return to that kind of inflation, we think equity markets are likely to be down, you know, 30 to even 50%. So because of some of these dynamics I just was describing. So I think that the notion that inflation is going to end up being good for asset prices is really mistaken. And furthermore, we're just talking about equities here, but one of the places that people hide is in REITs. And, you know, the cap rates on these are really just so low now because the risk-free rate has just been pushed down so low and the term rates have been pushed down so low that all of these types of assets, the prices are so high that I don't see how inflation yields a great result in REITs. I think people lose money in REITs. I think they'll lose money in REITs, they'll lose money in equities.
Eric, one final question on this matter of equities and whether they go up with inflation and so forth. I know you've done a lot of work looking at different equity markets around the world in terms of how they've performed, both in real and in nominal terms. Give us the overview. Unfortunately, we can't go into too much detail on that today, but give us the overview of your work in that area.
Okay, really high level. People assume that equities always go up, and they certainly have been for an awful long time in the U.S., but they can go through really long periods of sideways movement. So if you look at the Nikkei, right? So I started my career in 1989. The Nikkei today, in nominal terms, is where it was in 1987. It's where it was before I started my career. It's moved sideways during that period. The S&P is up over 800%. In that period of time. So we've outperformed the Nikkei from 1987 by over 800%. Euro stocks, right? European, their big equity index, it is unchanged from where it was in 1998, 20 years ago. We're up 130% during that period of time, the S&P 500 is. And the Shanghai Composite is unchanged from where it was in 2006 at this point. So it's unchanged over the past 12 years, despite the enormous real and nominal GDP growth out of China. Their equity market is flat for 12 years. We're up 90%. So it's just a reminder that we go through these periods of assets doing extremely well, pricing in all kinds of robust growth for the future, and then periods where they can obviously have big corrections, but even over long periods of time, they can just move sideways.
Well, Eric, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. I'd love to go deep on Lindsay Politi's piece on inflation. I, again, really want to recommend that our listeners read that. It was very enlightening for me, and I think it makes an excellent argument that kind of presents the other side of the story. We recently interviewed Russell Napier, who makes the deflationary case, and I thought Lindsay's piece was really an excellent complement to that to show the other side of the argument. In the interest of time, we're going to have to leave it there. But before we go, just please tell us very briefly, where can people follow your work and give us a very quick summary of what you do at One River Asset Management?
Sure. We manage macro money. We have a volatility fund and a trend fund, a systematic trend. And Lindsay is in the process of launching an inflation fund to capitalize on opportunities that we see emerging in inflation.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for a terrific interview. Kevin Muir and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts.
Great interview, Eric. In the market wrap, you mentioned that you had more to talk about in terms of time spreads near the front of the WTI term structure. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, Kevin, this is a conversation that goes all the way back to our show with Anas Al-Haji and Joe McMonagle a couple of weeks ago. And we ran out of time, and I didn't get a chance to get into my charts. But what my charts that I had prepared for that show were all about, and what I did ask them at the very end of the program about, is, hey, guys, look at the time spreads on WTI. The patterns here do not follow historical norms. Something is funky. And at that point, we had seen the August to September spread and the September to October spread that had traded below 20 cents pop up to 40 cents. It was like, holy cow, 40 cents. The number doubled. And I was saying, guys, look at these 2 1-month spreads diverging from the pack, doing something completely out of sync with what all of the other 1-month spreads are doing. What's going on? And nobody really had an answer. So I don't know where the market originally got its signal that something was awry, but what happened was on Thursday last week, June 21st, there was an absolute blowout in WTI time spreads, moving from about 31 cents a couple of days before all the way up in the course of 2 days, Thursday and then Friday, moving all the way up to $1.75 on August to September, and up to over $1.30 on September to October. What we're talking about here is the difference in price from one delivery month to the next. So in other words, if you want to take delivery of your WTI crude oil in Cushing, Oklahoma, which is where the delivery position is for the WTI crude oil futures contract, it costs an extra $1.75 to get it in August instead of September. Now, the only reason for that crazy kind of spread, it's not unusual to have 10, 15, 25 cent spreads, but to see the spread go to $1.75, what it means is there is a physical market crisis where there's not enough oil on hand in Cushing, Oklahoma, or people think that there's not going to be enough. Now, what happened on that Thursday is everybody in the market was going crazy. I was on the phone to Pat Hemsworth and everybody else that I knew saying, guys, what the heck is going on? Because I trade these spreads. They affect me very directly. I was trying to figure out what had happened that had blown them up. And nobody knew. Everybody was freaking out. And I think the reason is this all happened on the eve of the biggest OPEC meeting that was more closely watched than any in recent memory. All of the trade press was busy in Vienna waiting for what OPEC was going to say next. And the rest of us were sitting in front of our screen saying, okay, we know there's a really big OPEC announcement. What the heck is it about OPEC that could possibly be causing the August to September time spread in WTI, which is all about the physical oil in Cushing, how much of it is available? That's what controls that spread. What the heck does OPEC have to do with this? Why is it blowing it up? Well, it wasn't until late Friday afternoon that we got the news supposedly to explain this, which is finally it was reported that Syncrude, which is a Canadian tar sands producer, was going offline, and they were going to stay offline until the end of July. Okay, now we sort of have an explanation, but I want to emphasize, Kevin, sort of, because I thought that through and said, wait a minute, there's a huge amount of Western Canadian Select oil in storage in Canada. Everybody's been talking about how there's this big price discount for WCS because it's kind of landlocked in Canada. They can't get rid of it. So if the problem is that everybody's freaking out about Cushing, Oklahoma being undersupplied with Canadian oil because Syncrude, one tar sands operator that was only responsible for 360,000 barrels per day of production, they're going offline. Well, wait a minute. There's plenty of WCS in storage in Canada ready to keep the Keystone pipeline going at full tilt. They could continue to supply the pipeline with all the oil they need. It might not be coming from Syncrude. It might be coming from WCS supplies that are on hand there, but they have the ability to keep it going. So why would everybody be panicking in Cushing, Oklahoma over this fairly small outage? Well, the next piece of news to hit the tape that helps to explain it is there was news out of Venezuela that they would be decreasing their exports fairly soon in the next few weeks, and that's going to have an impact on the market. Okay, now if you go back to our conversation with Pat Hemsworth on the program a few months ago, she explained why heavy oil that's used as blend stock is so important to the market. All of this shale oil, in terms of its specific gravity, is too light to refine in U.S. refineries the way it is. It has to be blended with either Canadian or Venezuelan heavier oil in order to get it to a specific gravity that's compatible with the refining equipment in the United States. So, if you have Venezuela reducing their exports and you have a Canadian outage, even though there's plenty of Western Canada Select in storage, which kind of makes me wonder what Syncrude really could make a difference, it was still very hard for me to believe, okay, I can see a move in the time spreads, but blowing out to $1.75. Well, I thought, okay, maybe what happened is that was before the news came out Friday. And sure enough, as we got into Monday, and by the end of the day Monday when the news was well known, we saw that spread of August to September from a high of 175 come all the way back down to about 80 cents. So clearly, the market is unpanicking. Maybe after we realized it wasn't about OPEC after all, the market is unpanicking. Okay, great. We know what this is about. Everything's fine. Well, the next thing that happened in the market was we had a really, really big sudden rally And it appears the catalyst that started it was the news that there would be very little leeway with respect to Iranian sanctions. The United States expected all of its allies and trading partners to cease all oil trade with Iran no later than November 4th, November 5th, whatever the date is. That started a really big rally on the 26th, coming off of $68. And the next 2 days, we got up about $4. Well, wait a minute, Kevin, if that's all about Iran, which is what everybody thinks, almost everybody is saying that, what does that have to do with Cushing, Oklahoma inventory? Really nothing directly. Well, guess what? That spread that had blown up to 175 and then collapsed down to 85 cents that everybody explained away as being because of Syncrude, even though Syncrude production really shouldn't have changed how much oil could fit into the Keystone Pipeline. Doesn't make sense to me, but it made sense to everybody else. It had collapsed down to 85 cents. As of today, it's back up to an even higher high. I think the high print was around 183 or so today. So why would it be, if Iranian news was behind the market, if that was the reason for this rally off of $68 all the way to 73 spot 27 as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon, why would the time spreads blow up in Cushing, Oklahoma, when they have to do entirely with the physical delivery of oil in Cushing? So one of two things has to be true here, Kevin. Either the whole blow up in time spreads that we've seen that everybody thinks is all about Syncrude and Venezuela isn't really about Syncrude and Venezuela, and for some reason that is completely beyond my comprehension, somehow the Iranian news really is driving that. Well, that's hard to believe. I can't logically ration why that would be the case. Or this big rally that we've seen that happened to be maybe the catalyst that got it started was the Iran news. Everybody is assuming that it was the Iran news that drove it. Now stop and think about this. The Iran news was just that what we said in the sanctions, we meant it. It wasn't new news. It wasn't a new bit of information. It was just reinforcing that the United States intended to thoroughly enforce what they had already said the sanctions would be. Everybody is ascribing this rally that's happened since then to that news, but it doesn't explain why the time spreads would be blowing up. The time spreads are re-blowing up. They are moving to new wides this afternoon. What that means is there is a huge, huge price premium. The reason the Brent WTI spread has contracted dramatically this week, at least in terms of front month Brent WTI, is because WTI is artificially pumped up by at least $3 as a result of whatever is going on that's blowing up these time spreads. And I don't think any of the people that are confidently opining about what's driving it are really sure of what's going on here. What I can tell you is that if you think oil is a buy here, you really ought to consider buying the December contract, which is trading much, much lower at a very steep discount to the August contract simply because of these time spreads. And I don't think that they're going to last. So there is an opportunity. If you want to be long crude oil, I would definitely suggest you consider looking at the December contract instead of the August contract, which is artificially elevated. But particularly if you're analyzing this market, trying to figure out what's going on, don't trust the stories that you hear about how Iranian sanctions are the primary driver of price in the last few days. I'm absolutely convinced there's a lot more to this picture than meets the eye. I'll be the first to admit I have not completely figured it out, but it is not as it appears, and there's something really big going on that is affecting the physical flow of oil into Cushing, Oklahoma.
Well, kudos to you, Eric. You've been banging the drum on these time spreads for some time before the market woke up to it. And now that it's the talk of the town, you're kind of way out ahead of it. You know, as I sat here and listened to you tell the story about the time spreads, it made me realize that if you're trading crude oil and you're not watching these time spreads, then you're really missing out a big piece of the puzzle. What do you think about that?
Oh, that's definitely true. And it's something that I would also say there's a corollary to that, which is, you know, you can see crude oil move pretty darn big, especially if there's news. There's so many people trading crude oil these days through the ETFs. There's a lot of hedge funds that are really not, people that are knowledgeable about crude oil that are just moving the market a lot because they hear a headline or something. So the front month price action You know, it really is pretty noisy. On the other hand, the time spreads are traded by professionals. The people who are trading these time spreads, the people who are buying time spreads right now at a dollar spot 65, it was actually over a dollar 80 earlier on that, in the industry, it's known as the QU spread, meaning the August to September time spread. You don't buy that thing unless you know what the hell you're doing. And people are buying it. In size, there is really big volume on these spread contracts because they trade as exchange-traded spreads. So you can see the volume of the spread itself trading. Really big volumes at prices that are just so astronomical that nobody in their right mind would pay them unless they really wanted to pay through the nose to get a hedge against the tanks running dry in Cushing, Oklahoma. What the heck is the risk of the tanks running dry in Cushing, Oklahoma, when even if Syncrude is going offline, you've still got lots of WCS and tanks that's ready to, as far as I can see, keep the Keystone Pipeline going at nameplate capacity for a pretty much indefinite period. You know, you look at the grand scheme of all this, the amount of oil that's going offline, it's about 1 month's production. It's through the end of July, 360,000 barrels per day. What is that total to in terms of how many futures contracts it is? You know, a few thousand futures contracts worth of oil is coming offline. The market is going crazy over something that is affecting physical supply. People are afraid that Cushing is going to run dry. And I don't understand why they're afraid of that. But believe me, the people who are afraid of it, who are buying these time spreads at $1.50 plus, they know what they're doing and they're afraid of something very real. But speaking of people knowing what they're doing, as a podcast host, I know I am way overdue to change the subject off of my ramblings about crude oil. You've put a fantastic slide deck together for us this week. Listeners, you'll find Kevin's slide deck. It's labeled as post-game chart book. You'll find that in your research roundup email. Be sure to download that because Kevin's put some really great charts together. Kevin, tell us what's going on here. Starting on page one, it says the past two decades.
Well, thanks, Eric. We recently wrote a piece about the Canadian versus U.S. banks. And over the past few years, it's one of the most popular trades has been to short the Canadian banks. And I have a question for you, Eric. If I told you, if I asked you what the price appreciation for Canadian banks versus U.S. banks over the past 17 or 18 years was, what would be your guess? How much better have Canadian banks performed?
Canadian versus U.S. Well, assuming that Canadian did a lot better through the financial crisis than U.S. did, and I would think if Canadian banks were properly discounted that the fear of Canada's housing crisis, which hasn't really gotten going yet, would have hurt them, but I don't think it has yet. So I'm guessing Canadian banks are probably looking quite a bit better than U.S. banks.
Well, you're absolutely right, but the magnitude might surprise a lot of listeners. The Canadian banks are up almost 400% in that time. The U.S. banks are up only 43%. That's just a huge number. And everyone kind of immediately says, well, it has to do with the great financial crisis. You know, the U.S. banks have suffered. Well, even going into the great financial crisis, the Canadian banks were up 200% and the U.S. banks were up only 42%. So the U.S. banks have basically been dead money for the past two decades. Meanwhile, the Canadian banks have been the darlings and they've just gone up and up and up. And I guess if you have a look at the return on capital numbers of the Canadian versus the U.S. banks, you'll realize part of the reasons why. The Canadian banks have had a return on capital that has been, and this is slide two, by the way, it's been consistently profitable. Even during the great financial crisis, they still return 3.5% on capital, whereas the Americans went down to minus. They were minus 2%, 3%, 4% for a couple quarters there. So the Canadian banks have been something that have been consistently made money, and the U.S. banks been much more variable. And not only that, the actual levels have all been below the Canadian banks. Now, you might ask yourself why. One of the reasons is competition. There's only six Canadian banks that dominate the industry, whereas in the States, there's a lot more competition with thousands of banks, and even though there's a lot more large banks. So even at the higher end, at the multinationals, there's a lot more competition. But one of the main reasons has been that the growing Canadian consumer bubble or credit bubble. And if you go to chart three, you'll see what I mean. The U.S., when you look at the household debt to GDP, the U.S. during the lead up to the great financial crisis was leading, and they got up to almost 100% of household debt to GDP. And then 2008 happened, and that's steadily been going down since. Well, the Canadians, they took a little bit of a break in 2008, and they slowed down how much debt they were putting on. But then in the last 3 or 4 years, they've gone out and spent like no tomorrow, and they've actually pushed us up to a point where we're actually above the highest level that the American consumer ever reached. So it's easy to see why the Canadian banks have been so profitable. They have a consumer that is borrowing more, spending more, and just using bank services. And then the next chart, which is the Canadian house prices, if you create more debt, it's pretty obvious that a lot of that consumer debt will go into houses and lift up the housing market. And you'll see that you can see the extent of it. The Canadian housing, national housing price is up 200% in the last kind of 20 years, whereas the US one is up 90. So if you're thinking about it from the profitability side of a Canadian bank, they've had less defaults because housing is keep going up. They have more and more credit cards that they're able to sell. They have the consumer borrowing more, taking out more loans. And not only that, all those loans are good. So that's part of the main reason why the Canadian banks have outperformed the US banks. But it was this next kind of slide that really surprised me. And I'm going to ask you a question, Eric. I kind of did some math, and I went and got the effective tax rate for the two bank indexes over kind of those 20 years. And I'm going to ask you, what do you think the U.S. banks pay during that period? What would be kind of the average rate that they had paid?
Well, off the top of my head, I would assume Canadian banks are paying a higher tax rate and U.S. paying less because Canada is known for having higher tax.
You're absolutely correct. And that's what I thought as well. But when I went and did the math, I was shocked to find out that the Canadian banks actually pay significantly less than Americans. The Americans, on average, or I used the median observation to make sure I took out the outliers, they pay 30% plus kind of number. Whereas the Canadian banks, on the whole, the index pays 22%, but when you get to the big six banks, they're at 20.7. So stop and think about that for a second. There's more than 1,000 basis points of tax difference between the U.S. and the Canadian banks. And you compound that over, you know, two decades, and you understand why, part of the reasons why the Canadian banks have been such darlings compared to the U.S. So then I started to think about what's going to happen going forward. And I've thought about it, and I kind of went through the kind of what's going to, what the trends are that we see in the future. So let's just stop and think about the Canadian banks in terms of the consumer credit. The consumer is stretched. Interest rates are going up, and the government is actually trying to slow down the housing price appreciation by making mortgage rules that are more difficult. All of those things add up to a banks that are not going to be able to continue growing their balance sheet and continue making more and more money. And not only that, as the government slows down the housing market, they run the risk of getting into real troubles because there's a chance that they haven't actually allocated enough reserves for when the bubble finally bursts. So we think about that. Then from the tax side, there's been all sorts of rules that have happened in Canada where they've actually disallowed certain swaps and other sorts of booking insurance offshore, because the government is looking at the Canadian banks and saying, hey, you guys don't pay enough taxes. And so the Canadian banks are just going to be paying more taxes going forward. So then we contrast that to the Americans. What's just happened in the States? Well, Trump has gone and he's put in a big tax cut. So now all of a sudden, instead of those banks paying 30%, they're going to be paying 20%. Not only that, he's in the midst of going and deregulating. He's rolling back a lot of the Dodd-Frank. There's all sorts of initiatives to make it so that there's, for every rule that they put in, they take out two different rules to get rid of the bureaucracy. And not only that, the consumer is in a much better place. The U.S. consumer is only at 70% of household debt to GDP. So when I kind of looked at this, I thought to myself, well, you know, this is a great way to finally go on and put on the short Canadian bank trade that everyone's always been looking to do. See, the trouble is if you just go short Canadian banks, you're paying the dividend. Not only that, in, you know, over time, stock markets go up. So you really have to be correct with your timing. But now all of a sudden, if you go and you go and you're going to go short Canadian banks, but you can buy U.S. banks on the other side, and you have the tailwinds from the Canadian banks disappearing and the headwinds from for the American banks also disappearing, it turns out to be a great pairs trade. And not only that, when you go to the slide 7, if you look at the price-to-book ratios, you'll see that the Canadian banks are trading at 1.8, whereas the U.S. banks are trading at 1.45. So the U.S. banks are cheaper. There's a lot of things going right. And the Canadian banks are expensive, priced for perfection, with the possibility of a lot of things going wrong. I just think that it's, for the first time, I kind of looked at this and I said, you know what, here you go. This is how, if you want to go and you want to bet on Canada's housing bubble finally cracking, this is a great way to play it.
So it's a pairs trade, short Canadian banking, long U.S. banks. And it's interesting how different people come to the same conclusions from different perspectives. Because when I heard you talking, you know, you've talked about the darlings and the reason for the profitability and so forth. And I'm just thinking about everything you're saying about Canadian banks is a story of unsustainability. Why have Canadian banks been so profitable and done so well? Because Canadians have borrowed and spent beyond their means, have not learned from the mistakes their American neighbors made, and the resulting housing crisis that it created. They've bid up particularly Toronto and Vancouver real estate, but across the country, real estate is at incredible values. Consumer debt, household debt, is well over 100% of GDP. You've got just all of the ingredients for a spending spree to run out of room to continue any further and for an unsustainable condition to fall apart. And as you said, you don't know the timing. Things that are unsustainable sometimes sustain for a little while before they fall apart. But what a perfect hedge is to put a stronger U.S. banking story as the other side of a pairs trade. So I love it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I've been waiting for the moment to go out and short Canadian banks. And there's so many bodies from hedge fund managers that have gone out and tried to short this bubble. And I didn't want to just go out naked short. And I think that being long the U.S. side of the equation, being long U.S. banks, which are cheaper with a lot of things going right, is just the perfect way to play this trade.
So the pairs trade is the Kevin Insight of the day, but I want to get the Kevin Insight for August 10th on the table too. I have a lot of people I know that are looking forward to seeing you as well as our other speakers, getting a chance to actually meet you and hang out a little bit over a drink afterwards in Toronto on August 10th. What are you planning to talk about at the Toronto event?
Well, Eric, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I really encourage everyone to go out and buy their tickets before they're all gone. When I thought about what I was going to talk about, it just came back. I had to talk about my kind of big picture belief that the end game for all of these problems that we talk about in terms of all this debt and all of the problems with countries borrowing too much and the consumers borrowing too much, it just, in my mind, it ends in inflation. And I want to talk about why I think that's inevitable, and I'm looking forward to sharing my thoughts with everyone.
Well, Kevin, I think that's a fantastic topic. It's one that's very much on my mind. As I mentioned earlier in the interview with Eric Peters, be sure, folks, to download and read Lindsay Pilates' piece on inflation and the return of it. I think after we heard such compelling arguments from Russell Napier about the other side of this, the deflationary argument that says we don't have inflation pending, to look for someone who really has done the thinking to come up with at least another side of the story to compete with Russell's view, which is very much deflationary. I thought Lindsay's piece on that was fantastic, and I look forward to seeing your presentation on the same subject as we get to our event in August. Meanwhile, we need to leave it there for today's show, but before we go, folks, we really need your help promoting Macro Voices. So please tell your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices. Most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com, because the more registered users we have, the more able we are to provide you with the very best feature interview guests. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email each week, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the coolest stuff that we could find, downloads to our own content, as well as other content that we could find on the internet. Kevin, normally I ask Patrick to tell us what's in this week's research roundup. I'm sure he must have told you everything it contains, so you can give our listeners a full briefing.
I would love to tell you if Patrick had passed it along. Unfortunately, Patrick has gone off the grid and we didn't hear anything, so the listeners are just going to have to tune in to find out.
Okay, then. So we don't know what's in this week's research roundup, but you folks are, I'm sure, going to enjoy it if you're so lucky as to be subscribed. And if you're not, by all means, register your free account at macrovoices.com. That's going to wrap the show for this week. If you write or blog about the markets, be sure to send us your content so we can consider it for the research roundup. The rest of what Patrick usually says at the end of every show applies here, too. Since neither Kevin or I can remember what that is, you'll just have to use your own imagination. We'll see you next week, folks.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.